This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, good morning. You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanisan. Sime Darby Oils represents the consolidation of Sime Darby Plantation's downstream operations worldwide under one new corporatized name. It's the plantation giant's effort to diversify away the volatility that comes with any commodity. So the question is Sime Darby Oils the future of Sime Darby Plantations? To get into this and more, I have in the studio with me Haris Arshad, the Managing Director of Sime Darby Oils. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roshan. It's good to be back.
And thank you for taking the time. The last time you were on, we were talking about sustainability.
We did, yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but when it comes to sustainability, 98% of all of your palm oil is sustainable oil?
Yes, and we can say it's 100% now, actually.
Oh, congratulations on that. I think that's a big step forward for the palm oil industry as overall.
Thank you.
But SDO, Sime Darby Oils, focuses on the edible oils business. It's a bit to go higher up the value chain in terms of the palm oil. What is the mandate that Plantations has given you, the parent company has set up?
Yeah, well, the nature of our business historically has been about producing crude palm oil, and then we sell that on to others who then process them into products, whether it's ingredients or finished goods and what have you. But we realized that if you continue to be an upstream player, you're exposed to market prices. So you can't really control your business other than producing CPO. But we've realized that companies who balance their portfolio between upstream and downstream can mitigate price volatilities. So hence, we've taken this view that growth for us from a profitability stability standpoint has to come from downstream. So hence the creation of Sime Darby Oils, which really is about focusing our effort towards building our downstream capabilities.
Right. So in this way, if prices are high like they are now, upstream does better. Mm-hmm. But if prices are low, then downstream has the ability to offset any damage that comes from the pricing there. How important are you to the future business of Plantations, of Sime Darby Plantations?
It's very important. So let me give you a bit of a context here. So if you look at our performance as downstream, say in the year 2011, 2012, we were very small. So if you look at our contribution to the bottom line, it was somewhere between 5 and 10%. Fast forward to 2017, 2018, we now brought it up to about 15, 17%. Now, it's still small in the whole scheme of things, but look at it from a profitability standpoint. So if I look at what we delivered in 2013, a downstream profit before interest and tax was around 150 million. In 2018, we delivered 270 million. So that's a compound annual growth rate of about 13%. Now, that's purely what I call the low-hanging fruits. So we've been able to actually prove that if you put a bit of focus on manufacturing, you can actually do what we call a value accretive business activities. So, but it requires a lot of hard work, Roshan. And then you might ask, so how do we actually achieve this? The first is about reframing our mindset. So downstream is not a defensive play. It is actually a value accretive offensive play. So we've done things such as investing in lean manufacturing, where we remove inefficiencies and waste in our system, in our refineries, and really try to manage costs. And we look at how do we then restructure ourselves so that we have the right people and the right doing the right jobs with clear targets, and we monitor them. And then this other thing about capacities and capabilities. So we've invested around building more refineries. So we added one in Kalimantan in 2013. So that effectively allows us to process effectively all that we produce. So the Kalimantan refinery is about 800,000 tons of processing capacity. That's roughly about how much we produce in Indonesia. So you can see we've pivoted from just a seller of CPO into a seller of products. And that has been a phenomenal success for us. And of course, the other bit is around sustainability. So you mentioned about how we are now fully certified. And did you know that in Malaysia, we are the only company that sells cooking oil in the domestic market that is fully certified sustainable under the brand Alif. We are the only one because we believe that about not just producing it, but bringing it to the market. And we are also one of the, if not the biggest shipper of palm oil, sustainable palm oil in Europe.
You were talking earlier about your production capacity. Now, what's the relationship between upstream and downstream internally? Do you get all of your feedstock from what you produce?
Yes and no. Our capacity is, processing capacity is about 3.8 million tons per annum. Samdabi Plantation as a group produces around 2.7 million tons per annum. So there is a deficit, right? In Thailand, for example, we have very large operations there, but we don't own any upstream. So we have to source from third party. So there is a mismatch, but you can't help it because you can't grow your upstream at the same speed and the same size as you can go downstream. So what's important for us now is as we grow our downstream capacity, how can we ensure that the feedstock that we source from other people also follows sort of the same quality or credentials as we produce ourselves.
Right, because sustainability is very important because especially when you look at the European market, they want that certification if they're going to buy from you.
Absolutely.
So let's take a look at the ratio, just to get a bit more context of the relationship between upstream and downstream. Mm-hmm. Do you have a ratio of how much downstream contributes in terms of profit to the group's business?
As I was saying earlier, historically it was in the single digit. We are now delivering about 15 to 17%. We believe we can get up to 25% in the medium term, and that we define by about 2 to 3 years. And the longer term is to balance it about 40 to 50%.
That's quite a significant goal right there. You'll be able to, both sides will contribute equally to the business overall.
Yeah, we attempt to.
So setting the geographical context, how wide are your manufacturing facilities? Because you've mentioned Kalimantan, you've mentioned mm-hmm. Thailand. I think you've got facilities in other places as well, in Europe. And is that Liverpool? Do you have a facility
yeah.
there?
Yeah. So we have manufacturing facilities and we have sales and marketing operations. So if you look at our refineries, we have 5 in Malaysia, 1 in Indonesia, we have 2 in Thailand. We have 1 in the UK, 1 in Netherlands, and 1 in South Africa. The origin refineries, we call them, which is those in Malaysia and in Indonesia, are export-oriented. The destination refineries, which is the one in Liverpool, in Netherlands, in South Africa, are in the market refineries. So we process and we serve in the local market. So that's basically our footprint. And to serve the customers in the other destinations, we have offices. So we now have a small office in the Middle East, and we're just about to embark in the Americas. We're going to open an office in over there so that we can be closer to our customers in that particular region.
All right, we'll talk about the markets in just a little bit. But before we go there, why set up an entire new brand to consolidate all of the downstream operations?
It goes back to the fact that we were once seen as a defensive asset. And it's a by the way, right? All these refineries that I mentioned to you, Roshan, in 2018, we all had different names, and these were legacy names. We call ourselves Unimills in Netherlands. We call ourselves New Britain Oils in Liverpool and Hudson & Knight in South Africa. And none of this actually brings about a singular notion that we are actually Sime Darby. So we created the name Sime Darby Oils to actually tell customers that we are actually an oils and fats manufacturer and not Sime Darby Plantation. Because, and this is my own experience, when I went to the US a few years ago and I gave a business card and I said, my name is Harris and I'm from Sime Darby Plantation, the first thing they thought was, we are in the bananas and the orange and business. So what are you selling oil here, right? So they couldn't make the connection between the products that we are selling to the fact that we call ourselves Plantation. So when we talk about what name do we carry, we want a name that is singular, that can connote the need for us to drive for a singular culture, ways of working, and perhaps identity.
So it's about branding, essentially. It comes down to having that, as you mentioned, that identity that at least you can easily, it easily pairs with the product that you're selling.
That's
so
right.
So as this brand becomes more prominent, are there any plans to spin off Sime Darby Oils, or is it always going to be part of the Plantations business?
The integration is crucial. And if there are two competitive advantage that we have as a company, it's one is the integration, the fact that we own the land, we have the trees, we have the mill, we have the refineries. And that integration brings a lot of value to us. The second is that we have the sustainable value offering. Now, we can't bring this to the market if we are a standalone business. So the integration between what we do in upstream, the milling that we do in midstream, and the refining that we do in downstream is an integral part of our value proposition to our customers. Consumers won't pay for our inefficiency. If we cannot bring sustainable palm oil that we produce to the customers in the most cost-competitive manner, no one's going to pay it. So we have responsibility as well to make sure that we can bring it to the customers. And because of the integration between upstream, midstream, and downstream, we do bring that to the customers. And hence, we ship about 600,000 to 700,000 tons of certified, sustainable, segregated palm oil from Asia into Europe.
So the bottom line here is that it all comes down to this integration. The thesis that you've got here is that if you do the start to the end, you're able to optimize all of that. And speaking of the bottom line, we'll get into your margins in just a little bit. And how are you going to deal with the changes in the European and Indian market? You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. This morning, I'm speaking to Haris Arshad, the Managing Director of Sime Darby Oils. And we're talking about, essentially, the importance of the downstream business to the plantations giant. Haris, as we've discussed earlier, the margins are better when you go up the value chain. I think you were talking about in the beginning, you saw margins go up from 5% to 10 to 15%. How profitable is downstream?
It is... it varies depending on which part of the downstream segment you're in. It's not right, I think, to say that downstream margin is better than upstream. In fact, upstream margin historically has been very good. It's just that you are exposed to the market. Your margin volatility is very high in upstream. Downstream, on the other hand, is a bit more consistent, right? So if you look at our products, today, about half of our business is in the bulk side, which we call the commodity oil that we produce, and the other half is on the high-value products. Margin-wise, you would probably get between 2% profit margin on bulk, and you probably get between 7, 8, 12% on the differentiated side profit margin. Is this good? The answer, personally for me, the answer is no. But that's the lay of the land. Therefore, if you then say, what should we do? If we have money to invest in downstream, would you invest in the same business model that we currently have today? And clearly for us in Sime Darby Oils, the answer is no. So we want to look at where else can we go that will give you a margin that's firstly is a lot higher than what we can get even for the customized business or the differentiated business. And a business where palm is seen as... playing to its strength. So what do I mean by that? Palm oil is the only oils today, ever, I would imagine, I would argue, that has uses across almost the entire spectrum of what we consume today. Whether you're talking about food, you're talking about this table here, it has oil that can be used from palm. You're talking about running your cars, energy, you're talking about shampoos, all of that can be derived from palm. And no other oils can do that. But as you go further down the more complex stuff, right, that's where the margin then expands. Do we have the right to play in that space? Most of us in this industry do not play in that space because we've been focusing towards this commodity processing and so forth. So we are not sort of exploring whether do we have the opportunity to play in that space, because that is where I think we should pivot towards.
Could you contextualize that for us? So what type of products are we talking about here? Is it just other finished goods, things like cooking oils, or are we talking about biofuels here? Because you were talking about this table in front of us. It sounds like palm oil is your utility oil. You can use it for almost anything.
Absolutely. It's like your WD-40, right? what it is, it's because of the molecular structure of palm, you can produce renewable chemicals. You can produce renewable energy, which is biodiesel, and of course, food, as well as home and personal care, shampoos and all that. So what do we do today? So how do we actually play in this area? So we have products, and we see this ourselves, vitamin E, which is tocotrienols that we produce under the brand Natrio. That gives a margin of about a GP, or gross profit margin, of about 40%. 40% GP margin is what the FMCGs enjoys. as opposed to what we get in the differentiated business that we do, the olefin fats that we produce, GP of about 15-20%. So you can see how if you were to pivot towards this sort of high value products, your margin just explode, right? But the challenge for us is how do we actually scale this? Mm-hmm. Because we are not a consumer product company. We are actually a oils and fats processor, if you like. That change in mindset or that pivoting, if you like, is the real challenge for us.
Yeah, because when as a oils company, your finished product is the oils that goes to the FMCGs, mm-hmm. right? For example, then they use it to make it into other groups like their shampoos and so on. So how is that relationship? If you're going into that space, does that affect your relationship with the FMCGs?
That's a very good question, Roshan. We are very clear that we do not compete with our customers. What I'm saying here is that if the raw materials that I supply today is simply used for frying, there's a certain margin that I can command. But if I were to produce a product that can be used for other higher value-adding activities, such as this tabletop that has base oil in it, it will command a certain margin. And that margin that I might command is perhaps 3x, 4x than I can from producing cooking oil. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go into the business of producing tabletops. Right? So I want to become a producer of ingredients or raw materials that play in this high margin area.
So you look at the FMCGs or the finished good manufacturers and be like, I'll help provide the ingredients for that product.
That's right. If you were to go and buy chips in Malaysia, chances are many of these chip producers are actually using our oil, because we're able to produce an oil that is very stable, that can fry longer, as opposed to just normal cooking oil that you can buy off the shelf.
And again, this is when we start talking about the FMCGs, or maybe the people like Nestle and Kellogg's, the big food manufacturers. But just shifting gears a little bit, the European business is very important to your oils business. And I think you've said before, you don't want to be too dependent on Europe, especially considering all the volatility we're seeing there in terms of the campaigns. Where are the markets you're looking to grow, if not Europe?
You know, sometimes when we are too hung up about going out, we forget that actually it is here where the opportunity really lies. So the global supply of palm oil is about 75 million metric tons. The consumption between Southeast Asia, China, and the Indian subcontinent is about 45 million tons. That is 60% of what we produce today, between Malaysia, Indonesia, and perhaps Latin America. If you look at the CAGR in Southeast Asia, for the last 5 years, is at 9%. And that is the highest, even higher than China and India. So we talk about India, China, Europe, so that's been in the headline. Mm-hmm. But really, the growth is here in Southeast Asia. People are eating better. People want better products. And we've seen a proliferation of technologies that allow for better products to be produced. And this is a palm-friendly market, ultimately. So, you know, it was a bit of a, an epiphany moment for us, because we said we've been trying to grow in Europe. We've been trying to grow in China and in India. Yes, those markets are important. We have good customers there. But our home ground itself is where we should be winning. So we now realize that if we really want to be strong and sustainably strong, we need to solve for the fact that this is the market that is growing the fastest, Southeast Asia.
But is that growth fast enough to offset any potential negative growth from the European and Indian markets? Is that going to compensate for each other?
I think the biodiesel policy that Indonesian government and Malaysian government have done, that will counter some of that, right? But it is a bit like a pressure valve. When there's too much oil there and prices are being depressed, you could then turn on this biodiesel capacity to actually absorb those surpluses. So the answer to the question is yes, because I think the biodiesel growth, especially in Indonesia, has been phenomenal. And this is the one that's now creating a bit of tightness in the market, and prices have been going up, right?
Yeah, I think this time last year, we were looking at prices in the low 2000s of ringgit, and now
don't
we're
remind
looking
me.
At... But Haris, we talked about, you just mentioned India just now. You know, now there's a bit of news brewing. Mm. Reports have saying that India has basically imposed a ban on refined palm oil targeting Malaysia. How important is the Indian market to you right now?
For some W oils, it's very important. It is one of our, no, I should say, it is the biggest market for us today. So let me try and sort of explain what's happened now, right? So what India is saying is they put a restricted importation on refined. Not to say that you can't import, it's a restricted import. But you can bring crude palm oil freely, whether it's from Malaysia or from Indonesia. However, India ultimately still requires refined oils to be imported. I mean, they can't refine everything for their local consumption. So here is then perhaps a way for the Indian government to say, if you are going to import refined oils, you have to get permission from us and you have to tell us which origin it's going to come from. Is it Malaysia or is it Indonesia? For us in Samdabi Oils, we have a refinery in Kalimantan, as I mentioned to you earlier, and we also have refineries in Malaysia. So it doesn't really affect us because we can ship from Indonesia if that's what they want for refined products. We can ship from Malaysia if they want crude palm oil. So for us, I think we are insulated, if you like.
Right. It's not a targeting of the company. It's a targeting of the geography the refined oils are coming from.
But, you know, at the end of the day, I believe that economics will trump politics, right? it'll play itself out, hopefully.
You know, when we talk about foreign markets, I think a big part is that when it comes to refining, a lot of times you need to export the oil there and then refine it there because it's a bit more difficult to refine and then export. Or at least the scale is a bit different. Are you looking at M&As to expand facilities in consuming markets?
We have a very ambitious plan to grow. And that ambition start from getting our house in order, getting the basics right. So what we attempt to do now is to further strengthen our manufacturing capabilities. Because despite all the improvement that we have done, I still believe that there's more that we can actually do. The capacities that we have, are really running it in the most efficient manner? Can we actually de-bottleneck some of the constraints that we have? And we can also try and sell better. Can we actually reorganize ourselves so that we move from just selling commodity into high-value products? So the long and short of it is we want to focus on make sure that our house is in order first before we consider any M&As. Because the bottom line here is that if I can't get my house in order, what right does it give me to go and acquire a business? Usually the best business you acquire is a distressed one and turning it around, right? So let's get our house in order first for the next couple of years, really make sure that we are slick and lean. And that gives us the opportunity to apply what we've done here for all the M&As that we might want to do.
So when you talk about getting your house in order, is it just about increasing efficiencies or are there leakages that you want to plug? Is that what's the issue right now?
I see three things. It's all about manufacturing. It's all about making sure that our plant runs all the time and that our plant produces the products and the quality that our customers want. Now, that's point number one. Now, point number two is if the plant runs and it produces what it needs to produce, can we sell it in a way that can get the most value? What sort of customer mix that we need to have, product mix that we need to do? And the third is ultimately we are still playing in a commodity market where prices go up and down. When you buy, when you sell, and how you actually manage those two can make or break a refinery. So we call that trading around the asset. So trading skills is very important. So we need to make sure that we strengthen that. We need to make sure that our manufacturing practices are robust and our commercial organization will enhance our product, both from quality as well as customer experience when they deal with this. So these are the three things that we want to focus on in the short term.
All right, Haris, when I started this conversation, I asked a question. Does Samdabi Oils represent the future of Samdabi Plantations? Does it?
I like to think so. We believe as management that the way for us to go is downstream, that the way forward is about monetizing what we have. We can open up more land. So whatever land that we have right now, that is it. And we have an NDPE policy. We have a no deforestation policy, which means which whatever land that we have today, we have to extract the most value out of it. Extracting value means that you have to go up the value chain, to use your word, and not only going up the value chain, but going up into the right value chain. So not just about refining, but it's about going into businesses that give us, you know, significant value accretion in terms of GP and customer base and product offering.
So on that note, will we one day see Samdabi Oils be bigger than Samdabi Plantations?
I don't think that really matters. I think what really matters is that can Samdabi Plantation then change the landscape in the sense that rather than seeing it as a plantation company, we are seeing it as an agro business company that really talks about creating value out of that 660 hectares of land that we own. And I think if you do that, then I think we've arrived as a company that really talks about value integration and good value, a good product offering to the customers.
All right. On that note, Haris, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Sweet being here, Roshan. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan for The Morning Run, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.